Captain Bauer, Reel 2. I think we were discussing the effect that ground had on positioning your weapons.
Yes. And picking up the threads again, it totally... what is the word I'm looking for? Nothing's coming. It totally dictated how you would place your weapons. Because the ground one was on was, generally speaking, little hills, facing little hills with paddy fields in between. And, you know, there were little hills and big hills, but you were on a very hilly area, most of which had some form of Korean grave on them. And you dug in, which we'll probably get on to later on, but from it dictated totally how you position your weapons, because there were sometimes no fields of fire at all. And so you had to dig in accordance with where you wanted to fire. But one sort of thing dictated another. The line was formed willy-nilly a year, I suppose, before we arrived. At some stage, the fighting must have come to, you know, and people decided that that was that. Presumably the Chinese must have dictated that. And, you know, then one started to dig in. And by the time we arrived, you went into fairly well-prepared positions. And your weapon pits and so on were already dug. But that didn't mean to say that that was satisfactory to the next lot of people coming in. And quite often we repositioned Bren pits, and we repositioned where we put our Vickers, and we repositioned where we put our Brownings, and that kind of thing. Because obviously one commander won't think exactly the same as another. But generally speaking, it was pretty much the same. You were facing a series of hills, which had been called something. We have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, things like 227 and 355, and which became the standard part of your language, parlance, as it were, you know, because the thing was there, it was static, and you dug in better than the last chap. But usually, generally speaking, you put your weapon where the other chap had, because that's where the Chinaman was, that's where he would most probably approach, that kind of thing.
And you mentioned using a First World War manual for this. What would this be, the Field Service Pocketbook?
Yeah, I think so. I think I could confirm that. But it was interesting that it was timely that I read this, because it was our regimental journal. It was Colonel Pete had made a few notes and on departure, and this was, I think, the book. Because no one had had to dig in as we had dug in, and the kind of weapon pits and the trenches, and the ongoing problems with trenches like latrines, water, and so on, were very, very much the same. You know, you had men living in a hole for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And so the problems were very, very much the same as they were in the First World War. Not exactly the same, but very similar.
Can I ask you about the journey out to Korea? How did you go?
Well, we went by ship. We went by, I think it was the SS Trooper, which has now been broken up. And it was a pretty awful troop ship, actually. And we went, it took us 8 weeks. We went via Singapore, Hong Kong, Singapore, Borneo. No, not Borneo. Would it be Borneo? I have to look at the map. But, no, Ceylon, I think. But it was a hell of a long way. And it took us 8 weeks. And, of course, it wasn't a very big ship and it wasn't very fast. And so the journey out was really quite pleasant. We had a certain amount of training. We had been instructed to take mess kit with us, and because we were going to stop at Flagstaff House in Hong Kong, because the incumbent there was DLI. and we took a certain amount of mess regimental silver with us, and so the trip out was really very civilized. There were other people on the ship, of course, but they dropped off at places like Singapore and Hong Kong, and we took on other people, and we picked up a few soldiers who'd been training in Hong Kong, and one or two other officers and this kind of thing. But it was a very good trip, and as I say, it was 8 weeks, and we got off at places. The one interesting thing was Aden. We went to Aden, and it was the first time, I think, in living memory, that any infantry battalion had done a route march during the day. And the Durhamite infantry being such as it was, plus the fact that we had Colonel Peter Jeffries commanding us, and he said, I can see no reason why you shouldn't do a route march. So we did a route march, but in full battle order, wearing steel helmets, but as in warfare, loose sections marching up, and we did a 9-mile route march in the heat of the day. It was a classic example of the Noel Card thing, and of course nobody suffered anything. Everyone was perfectly fit. Everyone got very, tired and sweaty, and it was very hot, but it worked very well. Very good for morale, fitness, all that kind of stuff. But yes, that was it.
What could you do in the way of training on the ship? Was there a lot of physical training?
Quite a lot of physical training. Quite a lot of weapon training. There was always, we had our weapons with us. We didn't have our Brownings then. But, always stripping, cleaning, rather like, it reminded me very much of going to the chaps, going to the Falklands, strip your Bren gun, put it together again, or whatever your gun is, and certain amount of drill, a lot of physical training, deck games, swimming. You could throw a net over the side of the ship, and so there was a certain amount of swimming. We had weapon training live from the rear end of the ship. I remember we used to, catering staff had a lot of surplus tins of dried onions, I think it was, or something, and so you used to throw these big cans out, and they were marvellous weapons, marvellous targets. And so we fired the Bren gun from the ship, and it generally improved the standard of weapon training. That was mainly. And we did some, the officers did sand table work, more or less every day of some sort. And then we had bands came on wherever we stopped. But that was the basic training that went on. There was obviously a limit, but, kept people fit, kept people occupied. Kept their hand in on their, with their weapons.
Did you have a long stop in Hong Kong?
No. There were no really long stops anywhere. But I think something like a couple of days. A couple of days in Hong Kong, a couple of days in Aden. That sort of thing. Enough to let people get off, have a walk, have a drink in a local bar, buy a few things, that kind of stuff. But never very long, because it was a long trip, and I think that they were quite anxious to get us there.
Where did you actually land when you arrived at Korea?
I think we went to Seoul. My diary would correct me, but I think we went to Seoul. I'm trying to look at the map over your shoulder. But I think it was Seoul, because that was safe then. And we went by train to what was called Britannia Camp. And we had another 2 weeks there. So the length of time from the word go in Berlin, as it were, finishing Berlin, coming home, doing our training in Yorkshire, 8 weeks on the troop ship, 2 weeks in Britannia Camp, was quite a long time. And Britannia Camp was geared entirely for British soldiers coming in and going up to the line. We lived in tents, we had mosquito nets, and we were, first time we used, open latrines and makeshift showers, that kind of thing. It was the last preamble to the real thing. I don't think we did any night exercises there. I can't honestly remember. But then, it was at that stage, I remember now, it was at that stage that we had people coming to talk to us. Because by then we were there, the people that were with us were the people that were going to stay with us for at least a year to 18 months. And any chat that we had was solid, sensible, intelligent stuff from people who just literally come out of the line. This is what's going to happen. This is what you will find. Do this, do that, don't do this, you know, kind of stuff. The state of the enemy. I think we arrived just when the Chinese artillery had picked up again, which was the bad news. I had a company commander who was pretty good gloom and doom, and that was, I remember very well, on the, I think the night before we, the day before we disembarked, the weather had changed then. It was grey and wet, and we were all feeling rather apprehensive, and all he could do was tell us the bad news, that the situation reports coming in were that the enemy artillery was much better than it had been. And so we were told at Britannia Camp more or less the stuff. And we were also issued with clothing then, which was going to... I think we got a certain amount of issue on the boat, I can't remember, but it was there that we were given our proper clothing and told about the weather and the things that we shouldn't do in the weather, and apart from things that we should not do in the line, you know, because it was immensely important, because we were going to have very cold temperatures. Things like drinking spirits was considered to be extremely unwise. It didn't do any good to, you know, it might for a second or two. We drank rum in the line, but that was an official issue. And that was bloody good too. But things like what sort of clothing you should wear and when you should take it off. Because a lot of the temperature was fine. Especially when you're digging, you took the boys were bare buff, you know, or string vests came in, and they were bloody good too. And that was our start. So that was sort of
that was tactical.
The end of the beginning, as it were.
So that was your tactical indoctrination, if one can call it that.
Tactical career indoctrination overall, you know, in a nutshell. But
did you get any chats on the political justification?
You know, I don't think we did. I don't think we did. Nothing sticks in my mind. I dare say that if we did, it'll be in my diary, but it certainly didn't have any importance. I think that they must have talked to us about Syngman Rhee and the situation, Panmunjom John, 38th parallel. Someone must have given us a bit of chat about that. And I think there was a news sheet which would have given us a bit of local news. That was one of the irritating things about the whole of the war, because when you were in the line, you could see these searchlights, and it was a sort of enigma, if you like, that there you were in the line, the chaps being blown up, when the bloody peace talks were going on over there, you know, and nothing was being achieved. And I think that politically we were as much anti-Syngman Rhee as we were the Chinese. In fact, funnily enough, we didn't seem to have any hostility towards the enemy. Not really. It was no hatred as far as, you know, one could imagine that the Germans and the thing and the war and the Japanese and this kind of thing. But there was no great... The Chinaman was an extraordinary enemy, really. They were very wily. You very seldom saw them. They always knew what you were going to do. And we tried to capture prisoners, and that was always the big thing, try and capture a prisoner. And very few were captured. And when they were, they had this death wish. We captured a prisoner once only, and he was very badly wounded, and he died. But he had no will to live, you know. Here I am, getting away from the subject again. But one of the funniest things about the Chinese was that when you went into a position, which was always done at night, you took over from, say, one Black Watch or King's Liverpool Regiment or the Americans, the moment you arrived in the line, say, 11 o'clock, midnight or something, you'd get, you know, welcome the Durham Light Infantry. They always knew. It was amazing. But I don't think there was any sort of hostility towards our enemy. It was a funny situation, really.
You mentioned not having any night exercises at Britannia Camp in Korea. Had you done many night exercises in Yorkshire in your preliminary?
Oh, yes, I think we had. I think we'd done a lot of night exercises, and my army background is littered with night exercises, you know. One got used to it as a matter of course, that your exercises usually led up to something that was going to be 3 or 4 days and nights in the field. And so one got used to working at night. Of course, one did a great deal more at night in Korea than I think anyone else has done. Of course, not knowing the war, because I wasn't in the war. But I imagine that the war was ongoing day and night anyway. But I think we must have done night exercises in Yorkshire, but not in Britannia Camp, not that I can remember. But there again, I could be wrong. I think our exercises had probably, by then it was finish exercises and get on with the proper stuff.
When you arrived at Britannia Camp, what was the strength of your platoon?
We were three sections, let's see. I suppose we must have been 21, about 30 men, I suppose, altogether. Three lance corporals, three corporals, which was the ideal establishment, a sergeant. I seem to remember we had, because we were something of a specialist establishment, I had two sergeants. I should have had three, but I think I had Sergeant Ryder and Sergeant Smith. I don't think I had another sergeant, and three corporals, three lance corporals, and I suppose, entire body was about 30 people. That would have been about right.
Was that up to your proper establishment?
Yes, I think it was near to it. I really ought to do a bit more research on that, but looking back at the establishment for an anti-tank platoon, the men you needed for drivers and running your guns and all this kind of stuff, it probably was, we may have been very slightly under establishment. I wouldn't be surprised.
What proportion of your platoon were regulars as opposed to conscripts?
That's a very good question. I think that actually there were fewer regulars. The regulars were in the minority, and like everybody else, we depended a great deal on the national servicemen. Clearly, all my I think as far as I remember, my NCOs were all regulars, and there was an element of, but it wouldn't have been more than 5%, I think.
Was there a big age difference between the national servicemen and the regulars?
Not really, not a great deal. Clearly, from the NCO point of view, yes, but otherwise they were very much the same kind of age. They'd all joined about the same time, and some had committed themselves and others obviously hadn't. But I think generally speaking, they were about the same kind of age, 18, 19, 20, something.
How old were your two sergeants?
Well, now, both of them had seen war service, and we were then in 51? They must have been late 20s, early 30s.
And how old were you?
I was born in 1930, so I was 21, 22.
How did you get on with your sergeants? What sort of relationship did you have with
them? Very well. We had amazing rapport, really. And, of course, you were living in a very much more confined way of life than one would have normally done. And so you slept with your sergeants, if you see what I mean. And they probably, I don't think, there were one or two positions where you had your radio operator, perhaps, and your sergeant, yourself, shared the same hutchie. If you didn't, you were next door. And it was I think, generally speaking, throughout the battalion, the relationship between the officers and their sergeants and sergeant majors and NCOs was was very good. Of course, you were in a very much more relaxed situation. And you were living together all the time. Once you went out of the line, of course, you know, they went to their officers' mess tent, sergeant's mess tent, corporal's mess tent, sort of thing. But in the line, you were very close. And of course, you hoped for rapport. I was very fortunate. I got on very well with my sergeants and my senior NCOs.
Did you find that when you were engaged in action or in training that things happened automatically without you having to give orders?
No, I don't think so. I think that it varied. It varied. I can think of one of my sergeants was probably, in hindsight, probably less active than the other one, and so he expected me to do more than my younger sergeant. He was less flexible. But what was the question again?
About whether things actually happened.
Yes.
Without.
Yes, having said no, I think a certain number of things did, and a certain number of things didn't. You led by example. You know, it's nothing new, and you had to be on parade all the time, and set an example, and it could have become very easy not to, but your line. Discipline in the line was the most important thing. And so, yes, although you expected a certain number of things to happen because you had given instructions, and therefore you expected these things to be carried out by your NCOs, you always, as applies today, I feel sure that you set your own standards and you led by your own example. I think so.
Were your sergeants also Durham men?
Yeah, both of them were, and I think my corporals were too. Yeah, we were all Geordies, generally speaking.
What
actually
happened?
That's the contradiction in time, because I think if you come from Durham, you're not a Geordie.
What happened to you after you'd been in the Britannia camp for your fortnight or so?
After we'd done our fortnight there, and we had ourselves, we'd done everything that we've gone over in our uniform and had a feel of the weather and the country, we went to the line to take over. Now, unfortunately, I can't remember now, without looking it up, who we took over from. I know as a battalion we took over from a light infantry regiment who were leaving as we arrived, but the actual position we took over from, I can't remember now without looking it up, but we arrived in the night time. You were driven up in convoy in the dark with all your stuff, and you arrived at your position, and you were guided in because and a certain number of people had been sent ahead as the vanguard, a few corporals. One was taken up at night time, and you took over the position in the dark. But you had a few people amongst them, a few people who had gone ahead, in the same way that a few people had gone ahead when we left by ship. They'd flown to Korea and they were there already. So there was an advance guard, and that's what usually happened when you were taking over a new position. A few people would go ahead to guide you in, and they'd been in the position for 2 or 3 days, so at least you had someone to have a rough idea, who had a rough idea about the geography and the positions and so on. It was probably one officer and 3 NCOs, that kind of thing. So one officer would go to company headquarters, and perhaps 3 corporals or something would go to the platoon positions. And you were guided in at night, and so in the morning, there you were, holding a position which was totally unfamiliar to you, having been welcomed in during the night or in the early hours by the Chinese, who knew you were there anyway. I remember very well the first morning, because it had been raining very, very hard indeed, and everywhere was about 6 inches deep in water. And the Huchi, which was the platoon headquarters, it was an area called Jan's Land. I know, we took over from the Australians, that's right. They called it Jan's Land, and my Huchi was 6 inches deep in water on the morning that we arrived. And very quickly, you know, I mean, there's nothing else to do. You very quickly take over the position and sort out yourself and find out what's there and so on. And fortunately, we weren't mortared or shot at. You know, that came later. But to start with, you had time to get into position and find out where the hell you were.
Did you have any briefing about the sector you were taking over before you moved into it?
Briefing on?
The sector you were taking over.
Yes, but briefly, in that, you know, this you're taking over from one, the Australian, RAR or whatever they're called, Royal Australian Rifles or something. That was about it, you know. I'm sure that there would have been briefing more at the higher area, but, you know, it was, okay, this is your position, you're taking over spot 232 or something, and, you know, just get in there and sort it out, you know. I think that there wasn't much more that anyone could tell you, because everywhere was virtually the same, you know, tracts of trenches, and with the Chinese in front of you, rather close.
Who actually told you where to go when you arrived in the line?
Well, no one really, because actually thinking about it as we talk, I think that what happened, it was a man per section was the advance party. I think the advance parties, in fact, were bigger than I originally said. It was a man per section, probably a corporal, a sergeant and an officer went in 2 or 3 days before. And I think this had happened with us. And so there was a certain amount of knowledge of the area.
So somebody from your support company would have been up there to usher you in.
Yes, and the gunners and that kind of thing. It was fairly well organized business, the takeover. And of course it was a delicate time, because if the Chinese, which they obviously did know, but if they had wished to make an attack at the moment of taking over, because of